We'll call this meeting to order, and it is March 17th. Happy St. Patrick's Day, everybody. Not everybody's wearing green out there. It is 3:06 on the 17th, and let the record show that we have present with us Representative Corrine Anderson and Gardner and myself, Wilson. And our helpers today here are my committee aide, Kathy Hope Erickson, and our secretary, Ellen Nodder, and our LIO person is Dawn Finley Grove. So thank you, ladies, for being here to help us out today. The agenda today is, I'm going to go down the line. It's going to be House Bill 193, 156, 185, 151, and 113. So we'll get started right away. The first bill is behind tab one for you committee members. House Bill 193, licensing of medical or care facilities. And Dr. Monsager is going to be here and walk us through the bill and explain it to us. And let the record show that Representative Seaton has just joined us.
Thank you, Chair Wilson and members of the committee. It seems like it's not been very long ago since I was here on another bill. So here we start a journey on a new bill today. House Bill 193 was introduced 2 weeks ago as a governor's bill, and I'd like to take an opportunity the same way I did with the last bill we talked about, is to introduce it with several slides, which I think you have in front of you, as to what are the concepts and purposes behind the bill, and then be available for questions. And the first slide is slide number two, asks the question, why are we doing this and what's wrong with status quo? As you'll see in a few minutes, the existing statutory and regulatory environment for that the department deals with all kinds of programs and facilities that range in size from major hospitals like Providence to small family-owned assisted living homes to hospice to ambulatory surgery centers to foster families. There's this whole range of licensing and certification activities that the department does. And 2 years ago, the governor, with Administrative Order 108, began the centralization process of bringing the certification and licensing activities together into one place and separating them from the parts of the department that pay for services, so that there's some degree of separation of the licensing and certifying from the paying part of the organization. Well, as we've started down that journey, it's become very, very apparent that these programs have all grown up independently, one at a time, with their own sets of statutes, their own sets of regulations, own sets of appeal processes, and they are sometimes similar, many times different, many times with different steps. So the first real purpose here is an administrative simplification and cohesion question about what makes sense, what's best practices for the department across all of these entities to make them as similar as possible. The other thing is in terms of cost of certification and licensing, is that even though there's a theory that we can bring together and centralize this licensing function, as long as we have all of these programs that are all very separate rules, the training of staff to be able to interact with more than one type of program is really markedly decreased because there's of the special rules that they all have. We're aiming for a day when if somebody's going out to a village in rural Alaska and there's an assisted living home that needs to be licensed and maybe a child care facility needs to have a question answered and somebody else, some other program needs a technical consultation question, that we could try and get to a day when one person could go prepared to do two or three activities rather than three separate people going in on three separate plane trips into that community. To get there requires us to go through this journey we're starting today, is to try and get to much more standardized and simplified rules on the state side. On the provider side, many providers have multiple types of programs, and for them to keep track of separate program rules also is an administrative cost on that side. Slide three tells a few stories. Last summer, there was a provider of a supported living home in a community in this state that was misappropriating funds from a resident. There's no current requirement for any licensure or any background check of that kind of a facility, And so there was really no state role in terms of anticipating problems or recourse for that individual other than to try and twist the arms of that provider to say, you need to do something here because this is a problem. There are some other stories here. An example of an assisted living home tenant who's fired for mistreatment. Facts presented to law enforcement. No charges raised. No. The case was dropped. So the person remains eligible to work as a care provider because there's no record or no court jurisdiction issues. Another story, in our state we have a nurse aide registry, and three nurse aides were found by investigative agencies to be mistreating residents in a 9-month period. This would be, so in any kind of a state where this could happen, well after the reported mandatory reporting period, two of these hadn't been entered into the registry. One of those two had involved physical violence. So we need to have a timeliness issue with our current processes that need to be improved. In another state, a person was involved in a stabbing in a convenience store months later. Somebody recognized the individual. This person was working as a long-term care provider. There was no background check that would have been picked up because of the court case that we could have known about this before this person started working. And then finally, on a personal care attendants, many times they work for more than one agency. They have to do background checks right now for every single agency that hires them. Why don't we simplify this and do this once rather than have to do this for every agency that hires them? Slide 4. Right now there are 19 different programs that are administered out of the department. 12 different statutory schemes exist to date. And it's just a result of having grown up over the decades, each of them one at a time, and each of them independently. So there's lots of complexity, there's lots of varying rules, and consolidation is not going to go very fast under our current statute and is going to result in lots of implementation issues. Slide 5 shows where we're at in the consolidation in the department right now. The ovals on the left are the activities that have been brought together into the Division of Public Health into this unit we're calling Certification and Licensing. The rectangles on the right are the ones still to integrate in and over the next 2 to 3 years, and it just gives you some size of the scope of the issues we're dealing with. But even on the oval side, those top two are both dealing with assisted living homes. They came from, one group came from the Division of Behavioral Health, one from Senior for Disability Services. They each have different rules. As we think about this and look ahead to this consolidation, there's lots of issues. For example, with OCS, the issues you were dealing with the other day, I think it's most likely that what we will do will be the facility evaluation, facility standards, but the licensing of the family will remain in OCS, for example. So I think that's one where there'll be kind of a bifurcated responsibility that will evolve over time and we will work together. Slide 6 lists these varying programs, and you can see there's several different colors there to try in a schematic way show whether they're licensed or certified. Certified usually means that they're certified by CMS to receive Medicare or Medicaid payments. So that's ambulatory surgery centers, home health agencies, hospitals, etc. Hospices, you can see there is in two colors, because at present nonprofits aren't licensed, for-profits are licensed. So we have, even within the same industry, we have different rules at present. Over on the right there are several in black that show stars. These are, in this proposal in this bill, doesn't anticipate licensing these four, but anticipates putting background checks in place for all of these on the right-hand side. A principle basically embedded in the bill is if the department is paying for care for people that are frail or vulnerable, we should be evaluating, and there's some regulatory role, if it may be only a background check and it may be more than that, including licensing, depending upon what the program is. Slide 7 just shows you some of the statutory things that are going to be changed if this bill becomes law, and is an attempt to show in a picture form various parts of current statutes that will change. And it's interesting, if you look at the statutes, that two industries, what I'll call industries for the sake of this discussion, have most of their rules in statute, assisted living homes and hospices. And it's apparently, whatever at the time in history when they came into being, their rules are mostly in statute. For everything else, most of the rules are in regulation. So there's variability within it, between industries, too, as to what's in statute and what's in regulation at present. Slide 8 basically then starts to answer the question, what's in this bill? The first bullet is to centralize the licensing and administration of the covered entities. That's mostly what I've been talking about. Then the next bullet talks about centralizing background checks and registry functions. Most of these industries have background check processes in place of some type, and they vary in the requirements for background checks before employment, early in employment, etc., and the reporting of that is variable. So this bill will define who's, for whom there are supposed to be background checks done. It establishes a process that in regulation will define what kinds of barrier crimes will exist permanently. In regulation would define what will there kind of crimes will there be some number of years required to evidence rehabilitation. And we're envisioning that we would use what exists for assisted living homes right now as probably the template. For example, if somebody has been convicted of doing child pornography, that would be a permanent bar. If somebody is in a bar fight when they're in college at 19, and now 15 years have gone by and they're a good citizen and they're got a good employment record, that would probably be one that a certain number of years have gone by, they're eligible for employment. So it varies with the type of crime and type of penalty. And then there's a timeline for implementation. Slide 9, a couple comments, more comments about barrier conditions. This is one place where there's great variability in our current regulations, and so this would be to try and standardize this. In most cases, whether you're taking care of kids or adults, it would be the same. It's possible that there are some few differences that depending upon the type of provider you are. All service providers with direct contract would be background checked, including volunteers. As I said, there will be certain barrier crimes that will be sufficient to bar employment. A registry will be implemented that deals with abuse, neglect of issues, and those would be that a registry would be kept such and available to employers so that when somebody comes in to apply for a job, an employer could quickly check to see if there's an automatic bar of this person being employed in this industry. If their name isn't on a registry, then the employment application could be received, fingerprints would be submitted, and a criminal background check would then be done. So it'd be a two-step process, and then assuming the person clears, then they would be good for employment. And then the final slide is, as we've been going through this consolidation effort, this is just one slide of hundreds of sheets trying to compare the complexity that exists in our current multiple industry with separate regulation process, and beginning the crosswalk is as we start envisioning moving toward standardization, what is the work we're going to have to do to try and take the best and what applies to the best. So it's only put one sheet that's put there for illustrative purposes to give you a feel for what the staff are dealing with in the background as we're starting this work and preparing for the day that this bill could become law. With that, I'll stop, and Stacy Crayley from Department of Law is the lawyer who's most involved in this, and so we're both available for questions.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Coring and I both have constituents who are looking, they're involved in the healthcare field. They provide services to people at home, to frail elderly, to disabilities. They provide personal care attendants. And they have approached us looking for some kind of database that will allow them to detect people who have been accused of fraud with billing for Medicare. A personal care attendant, for example, who they fire for false billing on their payroll. They're responsible to repay what was billed. But then they let the person go. They're aware of several such circumstances, but that person then goes to work with another agency and can do the same thing, and they have no way, legal way, to tell the other agency. So I'm interested in your registry that would deal with anyone who's been accused of abuse or neglect or whatever. They can check that. Would that include also fraud allegations?
Can I ask Stacy Crayley to join me? Because I think that gets at one of the core questions of the registry value.
Is
It's like you fed the question out onto the table. That was pretty amazing.
I'm sitting here with their proposal in front of me.
For the record, my name is Stacy Crayley, and I'm a senior assistant attorney general with the Department of Law. And through the chair, Representative Gardner, the way I understand the theoretical concept of this abuse registry, would include a finding of fraud in that context, if there was some sort of determination that an individual had been terminated for fraudulent billing activities and that sort of thing. The abuse registry has created a lot of discussion within our department and the Department of Health and Social Services in determining how it will actually be created, what we envision it to look like, how will we work, what will be included on it. But the idea is to create a civil registry that would include all of these types of instances that a prospective employer would want to know about before making a determination about whether to hire them for any service. Mm-hmm. So I would say yes.
Follow up, Representative Gardner.
Thank you. There are some, I think, ticklish areas. If the amounts are small, there's no investigation, no conviction, no restitution order or whatever. So the person that has been fired from their job for fraud, maybe there's no record of it. It's not been proven, really. And I think these are fields where people move around a lot. A lot of people are minimally skilled, or they work part-time and they go from agency to agency for a variety of reasons. And it seems to me that the possibility exists for a lot of sort of low-grade malfeasance that wouldn't be captured unless somebody followed up with a prosecution or charges.
Again, through the chair, Representative Gardner, you make a very good point, not just with respect to the kind of low-level misconduct or malfeasance, but the types of instances where, you know, there is no criminal or follow-up either through a civil court, China proceeding, child in need of aid proceeding, or adult protective services or what have you, or even through quality assurance through the Department of Health and Social Services various divisions. What I think we're envisioning and how, there's a lot of questions with respect to the registry, and we think it has an inherent value to the process and how it works. We're still trying to, you know, figure that out. But what I think you're talking about is there would be a mechanism by which an employer who terminated an employee for misappropriation or a misdeed, whatever that may be, big or small or large, would then notify the state of the violation or the termination and the basis for the termination, and then the idea would be to place the name on the registry or to provide notice to the individual that the name would be placed on the registry, and then provide them with some sort of hearing to determine, make, you know, that their due process rights were, well, let's just say the employer didn't like the employee and there was no malfeasance, there was no mistake. So we want to make sure that we're not improperly placing individuals on the list, as well as putting people on the list that properly should be there. So we have to develop a process by which individuals' due process rights would be protected before they would be placed on the name. But it would be a requirement of the employer to provide notice to the department that they want a name placed on the registry, and then the department would have a process by which they would notify the individual, tell them that this is, and this is not in the statute, but it's what we're kind of contemplating and trying to figure out, that you would put it all together and make a presentation so that the individual would have an ability to preclude their name from being on the list if that would be appropriate, or it would be placed on the list.
Okay. Dr. Masagra.
Through the chair, the other thing I would add to that is we're looking for ideas about how to make this registry idea the best value it would have at a reasonable cost and at a way that does all the things that Stacy said. And so the proposal, you can see in front of you what's included, and we're having, I'd say, fairly intense internal debates about what other things should be in there, how do we deal with constitutional issues and so on. So if people have ideas about that, we're sure looking for ideas about this part.
And if somebody who's a provider, care provider, wanted to participate in that process, who should they contact?
Probably me.
Okay, thank you.
Do we have any other questions? Is there anyone online that would like to? Okay. Nothing online. Is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify on this bill? Okay, Representative Seaton.
Yeah, I just, on the last point that we're talking about, I just have, and I'm sure the Department of Law must have the same concerns as a employer. You get into that sticky problem of writing a reference or not writing a reference, and whether you can be taken to court for basically precluding somebody else from getting a job. And it seems to me that unless there is some substantial hearing process that goes through, that will find some liability for the or some limitation on liability for the employer who sends forth a name and says this person should not be allowed to practice, you know, to have a job in this area anymore, is basically what you're saying by putting the getting the name on the list. I think you're going to have a hard time having agencies or employers coming forward if they are looking at a legal liability of getting sued by the person who is has been terminated from employment. So I just raise that as one of the little flags under the investigation to make sure that whatever goes forward has a high standard of hearing, and also that there is some immunity that can be provided to someone that puts forward a name if the hearing does at least find that there is cause for that action. So
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, for your information, we've hopefully caught that question already. And if you look on page 13, we're on right version here. I've got a lot of bills in my mind today, as I'm sure you all do too. I'm on page 13 of House Bill 93, and it's section 4732-170. There's an immunity section, subparagraph C, which addresses the liability and the criminal history check, but we should probably look at that with respect to the abuse registry as well. So that we appreciate that comment. We'll take a look at that.
Okay. Let the record show, too, that Representative Cisna joined us at about 3:22, and Representative McGuire has just joined us. Okay. What is the committee's wishes on this bill? There are two fiscal notes. Also, Representative.
I wasn't actually prepared to offer an amendment, but I just had a question. Since we are dealing with a bill that is being touted as an efficiency measure, are there any costs to be saved in this legislation? The fiscal notes don't seem to reflect that. Or is it just simply efficiency in terms of delivering services?
Representative Corn, through the chair.
Which is a good thing.
I've asked the question too. I said, okay, we think that this will be more efficient. What are the cost savings going to be? Can we quantify them? And so far we look at each other and say, it seems more efficient. Does it attach to dollars? None of us have been able to come up to a dollar either on our side or the provider side. And so that's why it's showing as zero.
Mm-hmm.
At today's point. What I'm hoping will happen if this evolves and comes into being and we make this work is, as our population grows and more providers come online, as we can keep the staff the same and we can demonstrate efficiencies over time by mm-hmm. building them in and then not having to come back to say mm-hmm. we need more people. But we got nothing on paper.
Thank you. Well, I hope in time money will be saved as well. May I as a follow-up?
Go ahead, follow-up.
Basically an unrelated question, but since we're along the lines of, I guess you'd call this regulatory reform, what's your perception of the medical industry as a whole in terms of the need to streamline the regulatory process? Because my impression is that it's quite onerous, frankly, and maybe we could use this legislation as a way to streamline the process of issuing licenses or whatever.
Representative Corn, through the chair, when we introduced the bill on the Senate side a couple days ago, ASHNA had testimony, and we can provide a copy of their testimony to you. And they commented more, in some respects, one, they generally supported this as a hospital nursing home industry. Two, they had some specific comments of things they thought we ought to pay attention to. But they didn't comment on your question, which I think is this one step in more regulatory simplification and efficiencies that should be coming around a very heavily regulated industry? Mm-hmm. That's a question to which I haven't, frankly, given a lot of thought, but it's one I'll lie awake at night and think about something I want to wake up in the morning. And
think about that question.
Well, any ideas that you might come up with, I'd be more than happy to entertain as far as any prospective future legislation to help the industry.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. Representative McGuire.
Thank you. Just a brief question, and you may have already gone over this. My apologies. I had a bill that would not end up in finance. Finally did end. Are there any new categories that did not previously require licensure?
Representative McGuire, through the chair, one of the amendments that the next, assuming this bill is held over, that we are working on to potentially bring forward, it has to do with the list that's on page 2. Mm-hmm. And I have a concern that as the medical industry particularly evolves out of hospitals and develops more freestanding services outside of hospitals, how do we have a list that includes some kind of a statement that there could be developed a checklist or criteria against which, when the risk to the population is high enough, that they would then be brought into a licensed and regulated environment. And I think you can anticipate the next time you see this bill with us, with bringing a proposal forward with language for you to consider that would get at that possibility, because clearly on the medical hospital side, more and more services are leaving hospitals and going into standalone types of service delivery. At the other end of the extreme, if one were to think about it, there's this thing that in our state we call supported living homes that aren't regulated. If you were to look at the definitions, for example, of assisted living homes, and definitions are on page 4. I should know this by heart already.
14,
page 14.
15.
15. At the bottom of page 15, assisted living home starts at 25, and there's a set of criteria that are listed. So if a person is a landlord, clearly they don't fall into this. But if they're providing food, housing, and food services, or assisting with activities of daily living, this, which really replicates pretty much our current statute, would say that then you need to be licensed as an assisted living home. Right now, there are anecdotal stories that are places out there that are choosing not to be licensed that are doing some of those activities that we need to deal with. And this would try and make it more clear what the break point is at which you need licensure or don't. And even if you don't meet that break point but have staff that are providing some kind of services, your staff would need a background check as a minimum if this bill were to go into place, which, and that currently doesn't happen. Does that answer your question?
And Dr. Mossager, now the companion bill is in the Senate.
Correct.
and they've made some changes.
Through the chair, a series of questions have been addressed to us, which we're addressing. We're working on a series of amendments, and I would propose to bring them to both the House and Senate HES Committee at the same time,
okay,
if that would be acceptable, and would be really receptive to any questions any of the members of this committee have to add to our list of questions.
So what we really, thank you. What we really need to do now is to bring up anything that you think needs to be worked on, because we're not going to move this bill out of committee. We're going to hold it, and then they will work on the concerns that we have. And I think one of the concerns that the registry, you and I talked about, you know, how cost effective it's going to be, and how repetitive it was. There were some other concerns. How are we coming on that?
Through the chair, I think when you and I were talking there, right now we have a certified nurse aide registry, and now we're proposing a registry here. We don't want to have two registries. We need to fold these together in some form, and that's one of the things we're working on right now.
Okay, I don't see any. Representative Gardner,
yes,
you had a question.
I actually do. One is the issue of employment. If an employee is fired for cause, I'd like to see some way for that to be reflected in the record, in your registry.
Okay.
That's one issue. But also, I'm looking on page 13, on line 25, or actually 24, it says the information under the history check may be, the information only can be used only as provided in regulations adopted by the department under 4705320. Is 4705320 part of this bill? Because I can't find it in here And maybe it's just a typo in the statute, or is it being created? And I haven't seen that yet.
I'm looking at you, Stacy.
Because I'm interested in knowing how the information can be used, so.
Yes.
I think it's, through the chair, I believe it's a typographical one.
Well, hold on. Through the chair, page 27 establishes 4705320, and I think it's, we're doing sections that may not be in sequence.
No, and through the chair, thank you, Representative Anderson, but we separated out the, let's see, in drafting this, we created this criminal history standards and the centralized registry, and I do believe that they're the first statutory site in subparagraph C should be 4705310, and then it should be 4705320, and those are the statutes are referenced on page 27 of the bill, 27 and 28.
So they're creating 4735310.
310 and 320 are being created.
Yeah, so in addition to, through the chair, the criminal history and registry provisions are being created, it starts on page 24, uh-huh. Article 3 of the bill, new sections under 4705, which creates this criminal history process, how you can get the background check and that sort of thing. And that's what it references.
Okay, thank you.
Such a long bill, it's hard to
hear. Representative Seaton.
Thank you. I had a question. We have this testimony from the Alaska State Housing and our Hospital and Nursing Home Association.
Oh, we do have it. Okay.
And the bottom bullet point on that says this new language introduces high stakes licensing remedy with various serious implications for all concerned. And then, given the lack of any recent need to take this action, we question the advisability of exposing the state to the magnitude of liability this could produce. I presume you've had this and you've addressed it, and do you feel that there were, or either that there were some recent actions, need for this action, or that we need to take it just to make sure there aren't, and have you addressed what they're saying as the magnitude of liability that this high-stakes licensing could produce?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, that's one of the subjects that's under discussion right now, is the example that Rod Beattie provided in Senate committee was the example of some organization like a fairly large assisted living home is not doing something right, and it's felt that the residents at such risk are that the department needs to take over management of that operation to make sure that the department realizes the liability that it's taken on to take on the operation, make sure that the staff ready to do it, to make sure that the residents are taken care of carefully. And I think his point is well taken, that as we envision this in statute, we need to make sure that there are steps in place, either in statute or for sure in regulation, to make it clear that the department is ready to do such an action. One, it needs to be ready to do it if it has to do it, but two, if it does it, it has to do it right, because you can't expose frail elderly, which would be the most common people at risk here, to risk before they're moved out to another facility or whatever is necessary, or another provider is brought in to manage the facility or whatever the situation. That was the example he gave.
So that you feel that you're covering, because throughout this it talks about the state's liability.
Right. That it's one of the subjects that's under discussion. Do you want to add to that,
yeah,
Stacy?
I'd like to add a little bit. Through the chair, the provision, when the bill was drafted in an effort to bring in the 12 statutory provisions into one kind of umbrella process, as Dr. Monsonger mentioned, we're dealing with not just Providence Hospital, but also an assisted living home that houses three individuals and has one person that runs the assisted living home. So you're talking about a wide spectrum of entities. When you look at what the premise was for that section, and it's not necessarily a new section in the sense that he's using it, it looks like it would apply to the hospital or to a nursing home situation where if there was an immediate danger in a nursing home or that sort of thing. Currently, you have to go and get this temporary manager and go through this court process. And we still envision having to do that because we wouldn't be able to go in and take care of 75 nursing home residents and place them. That process would still be in place, and there's provisions under the general, the powers of the department to create waivers, variances, and exemptions from the requirements of this chapter, and we envision that happening for these larger type entities. What that allows us to do is for the individual where you have a, for an example, an assisted living home where an individual is at immediate risk, and you go out, you get a report, you go out, and it is obvious you don't have time to ask questions. You're just going to remove a resident, place them, and then come back and deal with this kind of, with the post-deprivation due process hearing. That's what that envisions. And for the instances that ASHNA has mentioned in their letter, we would envision having that court process, that temporary manager process in place because from a legal standpoint and from a management standpoint, we just simply couldn't come in and take over Providence Hospital if we found there was a big problem. I mean, I don't envision that happening, but it just practically wouldn't be how it would be handled.
Representative Seaton.
Yeah, a follow-up on that. And I know it seems a smaller point with three people than it does with 75, but actually you're probably coming into somebody's home, and it seems like the option must be just to remove the people instead of coming in and taking over the management of somebody's home. And is that all laid out, or will that be all laid out at what point you are, taking that situation?
Through the chair, yes, it will all be laid out through regulation as to when those differentiations would take place. But yes, you would in most of those instances go in and you would remove the individuals and place them in a new home as opposed to coming in and putting somebody in there to manage that home.
And through the chair, the current regulations say assisted living homes right now have this big gamut that run from three residents up to many residents, and as Stacy said, has this very differentiation about when you would bring in a manager of the home or when you would remove the residents from a small place. Leave the individuals well known in their own home without the residents.
I have a comment too on the next to the last page of the hospital, Mr. Beatty's. It talks about the assisted living home that they felt that the definition was out of date because of the ADLs or that's activities of daily living. Are you going to work on that? Because that does seem like a valid concern.
Through the chair, I've had a fair bit of conversation about this one since the other day. And Pioneer Homes are an example of an organization. We have homes at the level three in Pioneer Homes where they have frail elderly, mostly Alzheimer's or dementia, but not entirely. And if we were to follow this definition, we would really close down a huge function of Pioneer Homes, or we would recreate level three of Pioneer Homes as nursing homes. So the current regulations allow for gradation within the assisted living, and this balance point between what's a nursing home and what's a level three of a Pioneer Home, for example, which is probably, I think, the example he was probably talking about when he gave this testimony, is, I think, the discussion point. When I've talked with the Pioneer Home staff since then, and there may be somebody here in the audience from Pioneer Home, they would argue that our current assisted living definition works quite well and that we have processes and regulation of Pioneer Homes that make sure that it's safe for the kinds of patients they take care of. But they're much more frail than to be able to leave the building on their own and require many types of ADLs. And so we currently have a situation where one might at one level say, that doesn't make sense. At another level, if you think about the functions Pioneer Homes have, and we want to continue that level of home-based social service kind of care rather than medical care, then we need to create in regulation the opportunity for that to continue.
Well, and also, sometimes there's people in an assisted living home where as they're there, they deteriorate. Mm-hmm. And so they kind of slowly start doing a few more things, and they're there already. They've got their client. And so are we going to deal with that? So that what would we do in those circumstances?
Through the chair, one issue is fire marshal issues. So again, if I were to use my Pioneer Home example compared to a three-person assisted living home where somebody has deteriorated in a small facility, fire marshal would require the person be able to get out, or they get out readily. And if the person has deteriorated to a certain level and the home doesn't meet fire marshal standards with fire doors that close automatically and sprinkle and so on, then that person's going to have to move to another facility. At the other extreme of Pioneer homes that are sprinkled and have fire doors and meet fire marshal requirements, that's a different category, I would argue, that to be able to take care of frail people. And so we've got to be able to accommodate both realities.
Representative Sisson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What I would like to ask is, I am sorry I was late. I missed some of the early briefing on this, and I'm trying to figure out the course that you see this legislation. It sounded as if it's not instantly trying to be passed, but rather you're working on this and trying to see all parts of it. And I'm wondering if it's you're going to be keeping us current with maybe the meetings that are taking place and give us other opportunities to be a part of at least learning about what you're working on. Is that I just kind of like to know what kind of flow you see on this.
Representative Sisson, through the chair, it's amazing how you guys anticipate questions that are going on in my office over lunchtime today, because we were talking about that question. And one question is the reality of this legislative session. We're already at almost Easter. What's the likelihood this complex a bill could make it through both the Senate and the House between now and May 10th? It seems highly unlikely to me, given the fact that it's got three committees of referral on both sides. So then, given that reality, should we get this started, have some introductory hearings, and try and create a process to invite questions? And then, assuming that it's not going to pass this session, should we then use the summer and fall for more discussions with industries and other people with concerns, and come back in January with a bill that has lots of industry input and we know the pros and cons, and then use next winter for a time to try and push this through and be finished? That's the conversation that was going on in my office over mm-hmm. lunchtime, given the reality of where we are in this session. I'm interested in your all opinion on that question.
Representative McGuire.
Well, in response to your first question, I would go with the latter approach because I've identified so many questions just from looking at it just right here, and I know other members have, and I would encourage you, you know, one of the things we faced with this assisted living regulation fiasco was that in many cases it's just a matter of involving the stakeholders at the outset. And there might be places where you eventually just agree to disagree, but there may be some places that you can find compromises at the outset that would be helpful to us rather than, you know, wasting our time. So that's just my opinion on that. Others may differ. But some things that I do want you to think about before judiciary, should it come to judiciary or between, you have a lot of language in here that's unqualified. And I'll just give you a couple of examples. On page 14, starting at line 22, this is the section that governs access to information. And if you look at that, I mean, that's one of the most broad access to information clauses I have ever seen in any piece of legislation, including the statement that regardless of the nature of the information or whether the information is deemed confidential. You know, you're dealing potentially with people's medical records. There are all kinds of things where I could just think right now. So what I'm hoping you'll do is go through and look at things like mental intent and look at things like what are the kinds of things that you think you'll need. There's another section I can't immediately find, page 7, starting at line 27, that governs the right of access and inspection. And this is also very broad. And And it doesn't even include things like reasonable cause. It just simply says that a designated agent or employee of the department shall have the right to access an entity to conduct a complaint investigation. Well, what's that? You know, you could be mad at your competitor or grumpy or want to be retaliatory, and suddenly now you've got, you know, all these state employees coming in, and when you go to page 8, to inspect all documents, I mean, all documents. That could be people's medical charts. That could be all kinds of things. So those are just a couple that popped out at me, but this section alone would take my committee a month, I mean, just to get through it. So I would encourage you to, you know, spend more time with it and then get around to members.
Representative McGuire, through the chair, the advantage of having introduced the bill is it's now public, and we can now engage partners, people that have points of view. And so it sounds like you all are on the same track I was at lunchtime, that we should get it started, make sure people know what's out there, and then trying to encourage you all, your other people in the legislature, and then the various industries that are regulated, and then have a whole series of working meetings over the summer and fall, and come back in the winter then with a bill that hopefully can then be acted on next winter.
Representative Sisna, and then we're going to hurry up because we've got several other bills.
And thank you, Madam Chair. And I believe that this committee has probably uniquely intense interests on so many parts of what this bill talks about. And so I would hope we're right there on your right at the top of your list of people to contact. It would be wonderful.
Can I, Representative Assistant through the chair, can I make one last comment?
Sure.
I would really be interested if there are two or three members of this committee, if we do follow that track and we work through the summer and fall, if there are two or three members of this committee that would like to be a part of that process, that could really improve it as we get ready to bring it back next winter. So you may want to think about that, too.
Can I make one follow-up comment, just for the record? And this is kind of both
your name again,
Stacy Crayley from the Department of Law. Just for a clarification purpose, there's some provisions in Section 1 that have been developed in response to issues that have arisen within specific licensing actions and problems that the department has run up against in enforcement of their broad licensing functions. But I would like the committee to be aware, and I'm not sure if it was clear from Dr. Monsonger's previous comments, is that the genesis of this Section 1, which is a centralized licensing and related administrative procedures, 99% of that is current law. It's just been cut and pasted and cleaned up and diced and what have you to create one centralized licensing statute. But if you look at most of it, it's not pulled out of the pie in the sky type thoughts. We're currently using these statutes. It just pulls it into one. So I just want that to be clear for the record, that we've took the best of the best that we felt, and we cleaned up the problems that we see we've envisioned in enforcing and advising the department, and created this centralized panel. There are questions and issues, and we knew there would be, but just so that's clear, we tried to take what was good and make it a little bit better.
Okay, thank you very much. All right, we will go on then to House Bill 185, Post-Secondary Student Immunizations. And is there someone here from Representative Chenault's? Oh, Eric's here. Okay, good. Eric, walk us through this. This is behind tab 3 in our... That's fine.
For the record, my name is Eric DeLand. I work for Representative Mike Chenault's office. And this is actually an event-driven piece of legislation for our office. We lovingly call it the Colton Bill.
Go ahead.
Okay. Ryan was 19 and woke up, thought he had a cold. At 3 a.m. the next morning, he went to the hospital. By 5 a.m., he was blind and on life support. And medevac to Seattle, where upon arrival, he was pronounced brain dead. Meningococcal bacterial and viral diseases are very, how do I put this? they have a 15% mortality rate. And the people who are not terminal end up losing limbs. Mm-hmm. They go blind, deaf, have problems with other major organs. It's just incredible. What this bill tries to do is removes the exemption so that post-secondary institutions shall provide information about viral and bacterial meningococcal diseases and their risk. The students shall also sign a document stating that they have received this information so they can have the option of immunization. And it's just the option. We aren't forcing the immunization. The Centers for Disease Control, the American Academy of Physicians, and the American Academy of Pediatrics do recommend immunizations for post-secondary students, educational students. What would...
Okay, Eric, right now, this is nationwide, that immunizations are required, but there are, for certain reasons, there are exemptions that people can... say, you know, because of religion or because of just the way their philosophy in life. So,
in the state of Alaska, it's an exempt factor still. So we would like to put this so the students receive the information about these diseases. When you're living in close quarters such as dorms or in classrooms mm-hmm. that size, this is a risk factor. So right. We need to make the students aware of the possible risk.
Okay, and the bill does not say they have to. It gives them the option, right?
Right. What it does is it requires the schools to provide information. And the students, once they've received the information of immunization, pardon me, getting tongue twisted, they sign a document saying they've received that information.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. Do you know if this particular disease is like flu where the strains change and there's various types of it, or is it just one thing?
There are, first of all, there's viral and bacterial, and going from those bases, it breaks off into many different factions.
And do the immunizations work for all of them?
Yes.
Viral and bacterial, all strains?
It has been proven with our military. Uh-huh. What has happened, they did studies from 1992 to 97 and immunized every person that was being instituted into the military for basic training, since they have the same close quarters as a student would in a dorm. And they found a wonderful success rate by immunizing incoming inductees.
Follow up?
Thank you. And are there any potential side effects?
To receiving information?
The immunization. I mean, I'm just that would, immunization.
That would...
Changing behavior.
That would be part of the information that they receive.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Coring.
Thank you, ma'am. Eric, is it?
Yes.
I'm just wondering why we need a statute on the books to tell the schools what they should be knowing. Do they not already know that this is a serious problem?
Most schools across the country are already even requiring immunizations, but that's not here in Alaska.
You know, if the schools here in Alaska know that this is a problem, though?
They should, but not all are taking action on this, and we believe that information is always a good thing to give a student so they can make a choice.
But if the State Department of Health and Social Services just sent out letters to school district administrations and just say, hey, this is a problem, be aware of it.
This is for post-secondary education, colleges.
Okay, well, how about to those institutions then? I'm just wondering why we need
to do.
Just wondering why we need a bill to tell them that they need to be aware of this. I mean, you'd think something of this nature, the way you described it, as serious as it is, they would recognize that and put out the information. I'm just being devil's advocate as all.
Sure. Not all institutions do. We're asking them to.
What kind of costs will be incurred by the post-secondary institutions by being required by the state to give out this information?
They already give out information on many diseases to incoming students, so this would just be an attachment to that packet.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative McGuire.
So we're requiring that information be given, but we're not requiring immunization?
Correct.
Why not just require immunization?
For excuse me, through the chair, for the same reason that she gave. Different people have different religious beliefs and other factors that I and I know Representative Chenault believe that each individual should make their own decisions.
Yeah, every school I ever went to, even college, you had to have your immunizations. They had to. Now, I just wonder, I guess another way to do it would be to require it and then have a religious exemption.
Yes, you can.
There are other exemptions besides religious, because some people just don't believe in immunizing their children, period. I was a school nurse for several years, and so, you know, just in a regular school, even with all the requirements that are, there's a lot of reasons, I mean, not a lot of them, but there's probably three or four basic reasons why people just decide that they don't want it, you know. Some parents, if there's a possibility that something will happen, even if it's a million to one, they're afraid to do it. So for different reasons, some people opt to not do this, and we kind of have to give them that right. But overall, Dr. Monsager could probably, do you feel like commenting on this? Would you please come forward?
And Madam Chair, just dovetailing on your comments as Dr. Monsager responds, can you give us an idea of what states or percentages or numbers of how many states require it and might have a few exemptions, and how many do what we do?
For the record, my name is Dr. Monsager. I'm the Director of Division of Public Health. Representative McGuire, through the chair, I stayed to listen to this with the thought that I might answer a few questions. A couple things about meningococcal vaccine initially, and then I'll get to your question. There are two varieties of meningococcal vaccine for this organism, for Neisseria meningitidis. This is the kind of meningitis that makes everybody fearful of meningitis for exactly the reasons that you talked about. Somebody gets sick with flu symptoms and can be dead in a few hours. Thankfully, it's very rare. There is a small increased risk if you're a freshman in a college dorm or in the military, and that's where the epidemics back after during World War II were first recognized. A couple things have changed in this winter. The American Council on Infectious Practices has just changed its recommendations about the vaccine for Neisseria meningitidis for this organism, and is now recommending, because there's a new vaccine available this winter, that all people 11 and 12-year-olds get it, all people 15 years old at the entry to high school, all college freshmen living in dorms, and other people at risk in the military. So within a few years, this is going to be common practice for most kids entering post-secondary institutions. As you noted, most colleges already included in their information. My son's a freshman at a college in Portland. He got it last summer in his information, and asking, just like you said, either notifying the increased risk, recommending immunization, didn't require it, but recommended immunization. We in the department are fairly neutral on this bill for some of the same reasons that Representative Coring just stated, is persuade, there's a small number of postgraduate colleges in this state, and couldn't we persuade them to voluntarily include it rather than have a statute, given the fact that immunization practices over the next 5 years, most kids by the time they go off to college are going to be immunized already with a new vaccine. Your question is specifically how many states have requirements for either information or vaccination or nothing. Most have moved to either requiring information or requiring immunization, and there's a mixture across the country. But it's going to change fairly quickly now with the change in immunization practices. We are a universal immunization state, and we'll have to include this vaccine because of the vaccine for kids, which is the federal program with which we get vaccines for poor people, for people on Medicaid, for Native Americans. And as long as we remain a universal vaccine state, all of our kids in this state will be offered, and the only kids that won't be immunized will be the families that choose not to get vaccinated. But it will get joined into the requirement for school attendance over this next year now, given the change in recommended practices. So I recognize the need for the interest in the bill, but the timing is interesting given the change in vaccine as to how necessary it is given what's going to happen anyhow.
Representative Fire.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just in follow-up then, so, I mean, and I'm kind of siding with you a little bit, I sort of feel like if we're going to make a fundamental policy shift to require immunizations, that's where you put it in a law. I don't know what more telling an institution they should give information or how you're even going to enforce it. I don't know. But that brings me to just one more question, which is, so if our law says you don't require it, but we're going to require you to give information, you're saying there's a second category of requirements at the local level that says if you're going to come into school, if you're going to enter a public school, you have to have an immunization, which I would assume includes a few exemptions for different things. Is that what you're saying?
What's going to happen over this next year, because we're a universal vaccine state, is we'll be putting out proposed regs that this is going to get added to the school K-12 immunization schedule over the next year. Now, how and at what rate, because the feds have to decide at what rate when they're going to add this into the vaccine for children schedule, but they have always followed the advice of this advisory committee. So I fully expect that over the next 6 months it's going to get added in. Then we will have to put out regs proposing to amend our mandatory our vaccine policies for schools. And if that happens, then over the next few years all the teenagers are going to get vaccinated.
So the short answer is it is a requirement.
It will be.
It will be a requirement.
It's not today. It's okay. Not today.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. I understand that'll be for K-12. Mm-hmm. This bill specifically deals with post-secondary.
Yeah. So you have this gap right now. This deals with post.
So follow up.
Follow up.
Thank you. So under the regulations that'll be proposed probably by the state, are they going to apply at all to post-secondary, or is post-secondary still going to continue to be this gap?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, I think post-secondary will still be a gap because we have no authority under state statute to regulate immunizations post K-12. Remember, it's in the education statutes that we have the authority to do that in the K-12.
That's what you need.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. Another element of this bill is that the student would sign a document provided by the institution saying the student received the information for an immunization. That document, does this institution have to keep it? Do they keep it on file? Who can see it? How long would it be kept?
It's the institution would keep it while the student is in that institution. Part of their file.
Thank you.
I like Representative Chenault. I'll make a motion.
Okay.
You want, Madam Chair. I think it's a little bit much ado about nothing, but that being said, I know that Eric's going to follow up with Dr. Monsinger and look at the education statutes on the books where I think you get the real teeth. Expanding it out to perhaps state secondary, post-secondary institutions. So with that, Madam Chair, do you want a motion?
Yep.
I move that we move House Bill number 185 with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes out of this committee.
Object.
And Representative Gardner has objected.
For the purposes of discussion as well, I think it's kind of tilting at windmills. I mean, it's a real disease. It's rare here. We anticipate a different kind of way of dealing with it. If this bill were to pass now, I'd anticipate possibly just repealing it when we have new regulations and recommendations, and I'm just not in favor of passing a bill at this point that we're not sure we need.
But we did, it was brought out that the new regulations are going to be for K-12, and this is post-secondary.
Well, we could look at it then. I mean, when we know what the new recommendations are and the incidence of this condition, of this disease.
Any more discussion? Then would the clerk call the roll call? If you're going to.
Representative Sisna? Representative Anderson?
Yes.
Representative McGuire?
Yes.
Representative Seaton?
Yes.
Chair Wilson?
Yes.
Representative Gardner?
No.
Representative Sisna?
Well, I have to answer one, so I guess it's going to be yay with huge, huge
questions. Five yays, one nay.
Okay. Five yays and one nay. That means the bill has passed. Thank you, Eric.
Thanks, Eric. He survives.
We'll now do House Bill 156, Alaska Commission on Aging, and for representatives, that's behind tab two, and it is Representative Holmes' bill, but we have a wonderful young lady here to present the bill for us. Would you proceed?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Barbara Cotting, COTTING, staff for Representative Holmes, and thank you for hearing this bill today. Like all bills with a simple intent, this never mind. You do have a CS in your packets, and the sponsor statement, the sectional, and my comments basically are addressed to the CS, because the original bill was there are some suggested changes to it.
Would you bring this?
Madam Chair, I'd move that we adopt for discussion CS for House Bill 156, version F.
Okay. No objections. The bill is before us.
Thank you. That makes my job easier. In the sponsor statement, there is a brief summary of the mission of Alaska Commission on Aging. And in 2003, Governor Murkowski issued an executive order that transferred the Commission on Aging from Department of Administration to Department of Health and Social Services. So in 2004, Representative Holm had House Bill 394, which actually put that change into statute, so that the statutory change matches the executive order, so that ACOA is now under HESS, not the Department of Administration. That bill also changed the sunset date from 2004 to 2008. So since we carried that bill last year, we were asked to carry another Commission on Aging bill this year, which we are gladly doing. House Bill 156 makes a change to comply with the wishes of Alaska Commission on Aging at its February 2005 quarterly meeting here in Juneau. I attended one of their work sessions where we came up with language that they were requesting that vacant seat be filled by a senior services provider, regardless of age, and that the provider be a recipient of a Division of Senior and Disability Services grant under the Senior Grant Program. The Commission felt very strongly that the expertise that would provide would be a really good thing to have on the Commission. Bill drafters, in their strange and mysterious ways,
infinite wisdom, you mean?
Wisdom. Have their own mind, and this particular bill drafter did not want to include regardless of age. I've already had calls, like from Representative Gardner's staff, asking if that which age category this new seat would be in, and I would really, even though the bill drafter says it's redundant, I would like to see, Representative Holm would like to see, regardless of age, inserted on page 1, line 11, after senior services provider. So it would read, senior services provider, regardless of age, who is, et cetera. Just so it's very clear and there's no confusion about it. If you have any other questions on the bill, I would be happy to answer them. We have folks here from the Council on Aging and Division of Disability and Senior Services.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The grants, who are grant recipients in general? What is the pool of potential appointees?
Could I call upon one of our experts to come help me with that? You both want to come up? I'll vacate.
For the record, I'm Linda Gohl, the Executive Director for the Commission on Aging. And your question was specific to?
Oh, just that the new appointee would be a grant recipient, and I don't know what are the grant recipient categories. Who's the pool of potential appointees?
There's a variety of services under the senior grant program. Nutrition, transportation, support services, in-home services for home and community-based care, CHOR, respite, Alzheimer's, support services. There's a whole host of them.
So they are people who administer programs that have the grants? Are they employees?
They're providers. They're actually providing direct services.
Okay, on their own or as part of an agency?
Probably as part of an agency.
So they would be like the administrator of the agency?
They could be, or a project director. They could be a board member of the nonprofit organization.
So it's sort of a broad affiliation with an organization that is a grantee.
And we were asked, the commission was asked at the prior to the February meeting to consider this seat being a provider seat. And they had good discussion and thought it would be beneficial to the community and as well as the providers and the beneficiaries and stakeholders.
Go ahead.
For the record, my name is Steve Ashman. I'm the director of the Division of Senior and Disability Services. And just to follow up on that, under statute, the recipients of grants have to be a 501c3 municipal government, or I'm going to use the word tribal entity, tribal government.
So the reason we would want regardless of age in there because might not be anybody over 65, you know, if they're working and everything.
Because they're not retired.
Sure.
Yeah. Okay. What about the Ethics Act? Oh, excuse me, Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
Do these boards administer any grants?
Through the chair, the commission no longer is receiving grant proposals, reviewing grant proposals, making recommendations for grant award, nor involved in any way in the grant award process.
So there's no conflict with anybody who is a grant recipient sitting on that?
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
In the department, it has essentially taken over that function within the Division of Senior and Disability Services and the centralized grants and contracts administration unit. And then the commissioner of the department or his designee is the only individual who is actually signing grant awards.
Thank you.
We do have one. We are aware. We thought about it today. Steve and I talked about it, that there could be a potential conflict and probably would be the only area that it would ever come up, and that is when the commission works on the state plan of services that has to be produced every 2 to 3 years and submitted to the federal government in order to receive continuing funds under the Older Americans Act. We have to do a formula allocation, which is a geographic allocation for how the grant awards will be distributed throughout the state. And there's different criteria and elements and factors that make up this chart of how the awards and the total funds will be allocated. And there could be a potential conflict if this provider were in an area that was going to see a loss, perhaps, or a gain in funding in their geographic area. Wouldn't be very specific to them necessarily, because it would be a larger, be numerous communities within a geographic area. However, the commission discussed any potential or thinking about what kind of conflicts of interest could come up. And they decided during the February meeting that they would ask the individual to refrain from voting if they, they did think that through.
Any other questions?
I don't have a question, but I have a comment.
Go ahead,
my friend Steve Ashman is supporting this bill. It must be a good one.
Man.
Do I hear an amendment to add that as of any age?
Regardless of age? I'll offer that amendment to add the phrase regardless of age on page 1, line 11, following senior services provider. So it would read a senior services provider, regardless of age, who is at the time of appointment a current recipient.
Hearing no objections, amendment number 1 has passed.
Okay. You ready to move the bill, Madam Chair?
I am.
I'd like to make a motion to move, what's the House bill number?
Bill 156.
CS for 156.
Committee substitute for House Bill 156 out of committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes, including the one amendment.
Okay, as amended. Okay. Any objections? Hearing no objections, the bill has passed.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. Now we go to House Bill 151. Responsibility for eye care after surgery, and the presenter is Representative Anderson. Are you going to?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I don't know if there's much more to present. I certainly am willing to give a summation of the bill and my request to the committee that they indulge me and move the bill on to the next committee of referral. I also am here to answer questions or to defer to the two ophthalmologists that are online who testified in the last committee 9 days ago. But I think that there are some folks interested in testifying in opposition to the bill, and I'm certainly amenable to listening to them. I think someone flew in, so.
Okay, all right. First of all, we've got some people online, so are you going to be here for the rest of the day? Good. I just didn't want to, if some people have to meet a plane flight or something like that, so they have a deadline. But we will go to Sitka with Dr. Wayne Hagerman. Are you online?
Hello. Yes, I am.
Would you please state your name and your status, and then give us your testimony?
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to speak. I'm Wayne Hagerman. I'm a private optometrist in Sitka, Alaska. I've practiced here since 1984, and I would like to kind of speak in opposition to this bill, as it will have a detrimental effect to the community of Sitka. In Sitka, we have a community hospital and a visiting ophthalmologist who has been traveling here since 1997. To provide cataract surgery to the community members. And the ophthalmologist is Dr. Tim Gard. He's from the Hillsboro Eye Clinic in Hillsboro, Oregon. And he has provided these services to the community hospital as a benefit to them and to the senior citizens here in Sitka who are unable to travel elsewhere to have these surgical procedures tended to. We have worked closely together over these 7 years and co-managed these patients without difficulty, and I find that it would be undue hardship for him to have to remain in the area for 5 days following this post-op surgery, and I wish the committee would reconsider this proposal, and that's all I would say right at this point.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Hi, Dr. Hagerman. This is Tom Anderson, and the sponsor of the bill. I almost said calling. I'm not on the phone. And I wanted to ask you, because we intend to, and I hope the committee at least supports this, to amend the bill to a 2-day requirement for the ophthalmologist to stay or refer to another ophthalmologist. Can you respond to that? And anyone else through the chair wishing to testify, if you could give your testimony based on a 2-day stay, not a 5-day stay.
What I would respond, first of all, is we do not have a resident ophthalmologist in Sitka, so that is not a possibility to refer patients to another ophthalmologist. And the 24-hour or 48-hour would seem to be an amenable thing.
So a two-day, you're more amenable to that than five?
I would say yes, and within 24 hours, I would think would be, you know, more than adequate.
Thank you.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. Dr. Hickerman, in the years that you've been doing follow-up care for the surgeon who comes to Sitka, have you ever felt that or believed that any of the patients you were caring for needed the services of the ophthalmologist who was not available to them?
I have not. And that is one thing that we have an understanding with, that if there is some complication that should arise that would be beyond my level of expertise, that he would stay and take care of that patient until that time is finaled.
And what if the complication arose after he had gone?
We are in constant communication about the follow-up care of these patients, and we do that very well, and that just has not arisen.
Thank you.
Representative Seaton.
I guess I'm trying to find out the practicality of a two-day stay, of a two-day after surgeries are complete. So when the surgeon is coming in and doing the eye care or the surgeries, does he generally, or would it be practical to say 2 days after the last surgery before departing the community?
Generally, I would say it is within a day or 2 days after his surgery.
Thank you, Dr. Hagerman. This bill has been a very difficult bill for me, and I've been swinging back and forth, and I actually made a call to Dr. Gard. He's the doctor that does come and do the surgeries in Sitka. A lot of them are patients in Pioneer Homes, the Pioneer Home there, where it's really difficult to get the patients out. He told me that he makes it very, very plain to the patient that if there's complications after he leaves, that they will have to fly to Seattle and then on further, you know. And he doesn't charge for the surgery any more than what Medicaid or whatever is taken care of, but they would have to have their own, you know, their own transportation. He did tell me that if we did pass it and it was for 2 days, that he would be able to deal with that and that he would still come. And that was my concern, because I wanted to make sure that we weren't making services less in any area of the state where there wasn't the availability of an ophthalmologist. He said that many times he stays a week. When he does come down anyway, he brings his motorhome and does that sometimes. So he said that he would be able to handle that. Let's see, what else did he say? He had this question. If we put this in, many times people will fly somewhere else, to Anchorage sometimes, from different areas of the state. And are we going to require that the patients stay in town for 2 days, because many times they don't? And that was a question that, you know, that's not in the bill.
But Madam Chair, we no, obviously not. That's at their own risk.
Yeah. And but anyway, he said that was, you know, many times he has stayed just for that reason, just to make sure that every patient was taken care of. And he told, I asked him if there was any time when somebody had to fly to Seattle then because of that. He said, no, that's never happened. But he said he felt that it was because the numbers were low, because he doesn't do it very often, and there's not very many patients. And he said that invariably, if this happens a lot, that there will be a time when it does happen. I mean, he said, just the numbers will catch up with you, you know. And he said probably it would happen. But anyway, I felt a lot better after talking to him.
Madam Chair, you mean to amend to 2 days?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And I think 5 days is quite a bit. And I think we all got the letter from the Medical Association saying that, showing us where they really weren't happy, but yet they would narrow it down to 24 or for 48 hours. And I think you all have that in your packets.
Which one is that, Madam Chair?
It's behind, I think it's, we have that in our packets. I think it is.
Madam Chair, I know that in the packet, the Alaska State Medical Association sent a correspondence, a letter March 4th, stating that they represent physicians across the state, concerned for health of Alaskans. They wrote in support of House Bill 151, and they didn't really even reference the 2 versus 5 days. So you may mean a different association, because the Alaska State Medical Association endorsed the bill, which are the doctors.
Who sent that? Brief of these. Looking for the papers, what
sure.
We were doing.
And Madam Chair, it's from the American Academy of Ophthalmology, March 15th, 2005, where they state that they support the bill but wanted to indicate areas of concern that was surfacing by the committee, from the committee, regarding common surgical complications. And they reference that within the first 48 hours, these are, and you've noted that it's rarely, but it could happen. Some of these things, as you, I don't know if the members are looking at that, but a flat chamber, wound infection, elevated eye pressure, different aspects. And that's, I think, where they're coming from. The 48-hour period is acceptable to them.
Actually, Dr. Gard, he actually teaches future ophthalmologists and optometrists, both. And he actually said that his biggest concern was two different the main ones were two different complications, increased pressure or infection. And so he talked about that at some length and how he thought optometrists would handle it and different things. So Representative Seaton.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I have that American Academy of Ophthalmology here, and as I see it in paragraphs 3 and the listing of items and the following sentence, it lists that these are things that can occur within 48 hours, but I never see in here that they say that they support limiting to 48 hours from the 5-day recommendation from the Academy of Ophthalmology, that they would support that. They just say that these are common surgical complications in post-operative 48-hour period, because we ask about a 48-hour period, but somebody can point out where they are saying that they agree that 48 hours is adequate instead of the 5 days that's recommended in their full recommendations.
This is Carl Rosen.
Yes, Carl, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I mean, certainly 5 days will cover endophthalmitis and that possibility, and also the care of endophthalmitis, where it requires intraocular injections of antibiotics, which optometrists cannot do. But that's why that number was initially placed, as we discussed last time. 48 hours will cover common complications as well, and certainly it would be preferable for 5 days, because it will cover all aspects of patient complications after cataract surgery or intraocular surgery. But, 2 days, if that's what it takes to get improved patient quality of care, then we can accept that.
I would feel better with that, because I'm afraid if we don't have an amendment like that in, we are actually going to curtail some of the ophthalmologists going into some of the more remote areas of the state, and we definitely don't want that to happen. So,
And Madam Chair, just in response, if Representative Seaton, my staff just pointed out, if you look the second paragraph up from the bottom. Mm-hmm. So sincerely, after sincerely, there's one paragraph, then the next one, two lines. It states, if I may, Madam Chair, the enactment of House Bill 151, and well, before I read it, obviously this letter is an endorsement of the bill, so they're endorsing the bill. And then they reference in that section, the enactment of House Bill 151 will ensure that patients have access to a surgeon within the 48-hour window in which the complications from eye surgery could occur. So in my contact with them and my staffs on the phone, they know that we're going to amend it. And you know, this is a letter of endorsement. So. Of the bill.
Well, Madam Chair.
Representative Steen.
Yeah, I just want to clear that as I read this letter, it does not say that they are revising their five-day, their recommendation for 5 days down to 48 hours. That they are saying that these things occur within 48 hours, and if we keep someone there for 48-hour window, then that would cover these particular items. But I just want it clear as to what this letter.
And through the chair, the American Academy of Ophthalmology encompasses all the medical physicians who practice ophthalmology, and they recommend 5 days, and that's what I wish we would do, but we're not, and it sounds like the committee prefers two. So if anything, that's compelling to show that it should be five. But they're saying, okay, if you want two, then we'll endorse two. That's how I read the letter.
Yeah.
And that's what they've said to me verbally.
It's obvious that they're looking at this and have okay knowing that it's 48 hours. And exactly. And I have talked with several of them, too. I mean, I really spent some time on this because I was concerned about that. So is there anyone in the audience that would like to come forward and
Madam Chair, Eric Christensen from, I'm an optometrist from Ketchikan. I've been in Ketchikan since 1990, and in Ketchikan we don't, like Wayne Hagerman in Sitka, we don't have a full-time ophthalmologist. We have an ophthalmology group that rotates through Ketchikan once in 1 week a month. They do surgeries. I do not particularly co-manage with that particular surgery group because that's been a choice of theirs, right? But if they do indeed have a problem, then they do call me. And I, in my career there, since 1990, I've been involved in three or four particular eye care emergencies with that particular surgical group. And all of them turned out fine, but most of those were within a couple of day period after surgery. They're using an older technique in Ketchikan. There are different surgical techniques that you can use, and the more modern surgical techniques are, there's much less complication rate. The older techniques specifically, where they take the lens out physically and then they sew sutures, use sutures to sew it up, is a technique that's done in Ketchikan. And because it's an older technique and the results aren't as good, I really don't prefer to refer my patients for that technique. Because if I'm going to refer somebody for surgery, it's going to be the same person who would do it on my mom. So I do refer most of my surgeries. Being in Ketchikan, I'm a kind of a border town guy. And so I end up sending most of my patients to Seattle. I've seen work from most of the cataract surgeons and other types of surgeons. And when the patient returns home, regardless of what day it is, and of course you guys have talked about that, when I refer to a surgeon, I am counting on the skill of the surgeon and the ability of his particular team that he's put together to take care of the patient, because with any surgery, the outcomes of surgery are much better when you have a team, and that includes the surgeon, but it also includes the other staff members in the office, including optometrists, to manage the patient and return them at an appropriate time to me. That's what I'm asking for. And the opposition that I have to this bill is that I don't feel it's the legislature's. I don't think it's necessary to regulate. The legislature shouldn't be regulating co-management. It should be regulated by the boards. I was a board member for, I just finished my board for 8 years. I'm the chair, but I'm done. So they're just replacing my position. And in that 8 years, I've never heard one peep from the medical board regarding any problems with co-management with optometrists, regardless of the time. Not one peep.
I actually called the medical board,
mm-hmm.
and they're all off doing their thing, you know, and they don't meet until next month. I considered holding the bill till next month so I could get some reaction from them. They are going to talk about this bill next month when they meet, and it's a fair, like you say, your time is up. It's almost a whole new board, and
right.
So this hasn't come up with them before, and so I'm hoping that we don't get this through the whole process, but I hate to hold it up at this end because we do have some more committees to go through.
Right. The concern I have is that you're opening a huge can of worms. You're opening up the co-management relationships potentially between dentists and oral surgeons, between any number of other healthcare providers that are in rural communities, where you are counting on, when you refer for surgery, you're counting on the clinical judgment of the surgeon that you're referring to. I live in Ketchikan. Somebody's eye goes down in Ketchikan. You don't walk in the store. You know what I mean? Your kids go to school there. These are things you got to think about when you're out in the community. When I make my decision for my patient, it's a decision that I do not take lightly.
Representative Gardner.
When you send refer patients to somebody in Seattle and they go fly to Seattle for treatment, how long do the patients usually stay there before they come home?
Typically, when I see a patient from Seattle, they are scheduled for a follow-up at 7 days with me. Typically, they will see the surgeon, right, have the surgery done, they're seen the next day, and then they're free to do, if they are stable enough, and it depends upon the surgery now. You know, if we're talking about, there are a lot of different eye surgeries, right, but predominantly it sounds like the focus here is really on cataract surgery and or refractive surgery, right, which are surgeries that a person can recover from fairly quickly. Then they're back to my office. For sure I see them within a week. My responsibility to the patient, for the patient, occurs as soon as they release them from the surgical facility.
Is it accurate to say that after they have the surgery, they're seen by the surgeon the following day?
Yes.
And then they come home?
Well, it depends upon the patient again. If they're having problems, they're not going to send them home.
Absent any problems.
Absent any problems, generally they make their way home. Right.
Thank you.
Representative Seaton.
Madam Chair, I appreciate the doctor coming up and testifying, because this has been my problem for quite a bit on this bill. We have a board process. And this is within the purview of the board, and now we have the testimony from the chair of the state medical board that the ophthalmologists have not taken this problem to the board.
I'm not the state medical board. I'm this and the optometry board.
Optometry board. We were trying to get information from the state medical board, because the state medical board, we've had testimony, has the purview and has this within their jurisdiction to regulate, and we have had no information that the ophthalmologists have taken and requested the state medical board to do anything in this area. And so I have a real concern that we are jumping into areas and taking one particular medical procedure and saying we are going to hop in to the place and put ourselves in the place of the state medical board and regulate a particular action. And now that we haven't, you know, I wasn't aware of other examples, but if we were talking about oral surgeons and dentists, you know, those are maybe the same kind of thing. And what's next? Are we supposed to put our expertise in place of the state medical board? So I'm very uncomfortable not having heard, not having had the state medical board review this item and make a decision on it. I know we have a letter here that says they support the bill, but, you know, just I have a real problem jumping in and putting ourselves in place of the medical board.
So noted. Representative McGuire?
Yeah, two things. First, on page 2, lines 13, and then I have a question for 13. Well, so it's 13, so it's A. We keep talking about the rural parts of the state. My understanding is that if the distance the patient would have to travel to the regular office of the operating surgeon would result in an unreasonable hardship for the patient, then it's an exception. So I respect, and I didn't catch
Dr. I'm Eric Christensen. If you read it, it says, in order to satisfy the requirements of this section, a co-management agreement for postoperative care of a patient must meet the following requirements. The agreement may be entered into only when the distance the patient would travel to the regular office of the operating surgeon would result in an unreasonable hardship.
Sure, so I understand that, but I mean, there may be other reasons, and I know Representative Seaton talked about the board and whether this is the right place, and those are all valid, but in Ketchikan, I can't imagine, or Sitka, or Bethel, or wherever this would be. Yeah, it does say only when, but I can't imagine that it would, if what you're saying today obviously is true, it would always be a situation then where the hardship would be there. I mean, you wouldn't expect a person in Ketchikan to have to get on a plane and fly to Seattle or fly to Anchorage or somebody in Bethel. So that's
for
just a point. And then the other thing is, are you required to carry medical malpractice insurance?
Mm-hmm. I carry $3 million of malpractice insurance.
And do you know what amount of medical malpractice the ophthalmologist that you work with carries?
I don't work with the ophthalmologist. I refer a patient to the ophthalmologist. There's no financial connection there besides that my patient comes back, their result is nice, they look good, they don't have problems, they see well, they were treated appropriately, both from a surgical standpoint and as a person. That's one of the big problems.
Yeah. And then just continuing along that, but before I do it, I want to say, you know, just how much I respect what you do, and I can feel the passion that you have, and I think that's great. No, I do, and I think it's important. But please understand that, you know, I know the sponsor's intentions are not to be disrespectful to you, nor are mine or any other of the comments of the committee. I got a couple of emails that said that the time this was heard before, that they thought that I was in some way saying that I didn't think that optometrists were valuable,
right,
or important or professionals, and that's just the absolute opposite of how I feel. I think that your profession is extremely important, valuable, that the patient care is great. I have an optometrist. I need them. I have terrible eyes. So I just want to get that on the record. But back to the medical malpractice insurance, when you enter in these co-management agreements, is there a direct shift in liability that occurs? Because one of the things I guess I have a concern about is, you know, when things go well, they go well, and then when they don't, with the eyes, it's a disaster.
It's a bad deal.
And so surgeon comes in, does the surgery, gets on a plane, leaves. Now you're there, and you're dealing with, let's say, a real bad problem on your hands. In the co-management agreement, do you shift, is the liability for medical malpractice then shifted to you for the primary act of the surgeon?
I'm not well versed in medical malpractice. I mean, in the tort issues regarding medical malpractice, I don't know.
Mike, for you, did you have any? You said something about 90 days.
It's my understanding that the surgeon has.
Hello.
That's Mike Bennett.
I believe there's someone online that might be able to answer that. Yeah. Whoever was online, just go ahead and start talking.
Hello? Yeah, hi. Carl Rosen here. The malpractice is shared, and certainly a trial lawyer or malpractice lawyer will find fault with both parties, but the primary responsibility ultimately falls on the surgeon's hands.
Okay, thank you. Representative Seaton. Now, first of all, you don't do the co-management except when they come back from Seattle, right?
Well, I'll refer them, yeah, when they come back. Yeah, when they come back, I see the patient, right, after they return. And it isn't just with cataract surgeons. It's with retinal specialists, corneal specialists, whoever. I'm the person who the person sees. I make the diagnosis. I say, hey, you know, Madam Chair, you've got this problem, you need to see this person for that particular problem, and it's not the same person. It's usually a subspecialist who's got expertise in that particular area. And then because, you know, patients are sensitive to travel costs, right, and issues like that, they like to get back in a reasonable amount of time, right, from where they've been. And I am trusting the surgeon to return the patient to me at a time when they feel it's appropriate.
Most of the times, though, when you have patients that go to Seattle, most of the times, and I know it varies per surgery, but
right.
What the general rule is that by the second day, they're on their way home.
Days two or three or four, something like that in there. It depends upon whether they want to stay in Seattle and shop or do whatever, right? Right? Then they come home, right?
Who is next? Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I just wanted to state and reiterate, since we're not just asking questions but kind of editorializing during this sequence as you've testified, I say we, meaning members of the committee, in reference to what Representative Seaton said and in concurrence with what Representative McGuire said on page 2, as I read it as well, I believe that the bill isn't, in your case, about co-management as much as it about the surgeon staying for 2 days. And I think Representative McGuire noted it, but I want to reiterate it, that it doesn't affect that because of the fact that the co-management agreement would, in this case, the surgeon goes back to, let's say, Seattle or Portland, the distance the patient would have to travel would be too difficult. And so I hope you at least can respond at some point, because I noticed in your testimony you didn't respond to the fact that a surgeon staying for 2 days.
Well, I mean, that's not for me to make. I'm not making a decision about that. That's for the surgeon to decide. That's for the person who's doing the surgery to decide. I am, if that's what the surgeon wants to do and his outcomes epidemiologically are good, nobody is hurt, and that's a working relationship that works with his surgical team, then is it up to the legislature to regulate that? I don't understand that. It should be something that should be regulated by the medical board if there's a problem with that. You don't do that as a legislature.
Well, I would disagree if you look at the statutes.
Well, but it's precedent setting. There's no laws like that in the United States. There are none that regulate that this particular thing, except for in Nevada, I guess. There, and I don't know the whole thing about it, but it's not something that is. I mean, it's a precedent-setting legislation, is what it is.
Okay, and we do need to move on because we've got some more people that would like to testify.
Any more questions? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Dr. Willie Shields, are you still online?
Yes, I am. Uh-huh.
Go ahead.
I have never been a board person. I'm a retina specialist, and I work in Seattle. And I have seen some patients from Alaska.
I co-managed
them in various ways. I'm unfamiliar with the testimony process. I understand that this is, I guess, a House committee which is looking at this bill, HB 151, and I'm gathering that there's people who are tied in by teleconference and then the representatives there. Is my understanding correct?
You are correct. And can you tell us, are you an ophthalmologist or an optometrist?
I'm an ophthalmologist, and I have subspecialty training in retina care. So I limit my practice to taking care of problems of the retina, which is in the back of the eye. I'll have patients referred to me and do have referred to me from optometrists and then also from ophthalmologists. The bulk of my patients, of course, are referred from the state of Washington, but we do also see some patients who come from Alaska. And as a result of that, then I'm very much affected by the co-management relationship, and many times the patients that we see are, you know, they're complicated. They're a little bit more involved than routine kind of cataract surgery. And there have been certainly several times when I've had a patient that's been sent to me, and it's then been my responsibility to take care of that patient and then to get them back to their community doctor. And that's what I do. And I've had a chance to read the bill as written here. I'm certainly not a lawyer.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 151 as amended with individual recommendations and zero fiscal note.
And I'll object.
And there's an objection. Do you want to speak to your objection?
Yes, I do, Madam Chair. I think that we've had a lot of testimony here, and I think the testimony has come down to that the surgeons should use their medical expertise and should determine when, within their medical expertise, a person should be able to leave. And what we are trying to do is insert ourselves between the medical doctors and their decisions and say that the medical doctor that says that his patient is free to go in 24 hours is making a bad decision, an incorrect decision, and we are going to insert the legislature into a medical decision and say that those surgeons do not know what they're doing and that we know better. And I think that that's a very big mistake. I also think that on page 2, line 12, where we say, this doesn't apply to rural Alaska. It doesn't matter about the care there. It only applies to Anchorage and Fairbanks, basically. And we are going to say that, oh, there's some people we care about, and we're going to do that. And I also have a real problem with exempting midwives and letting them be co-managers and not ophthalmologists. So I have a real problem with aspects of the bill, but especially that we're inserting ourselves in here and basically overriding the state medical board, or not overriding them, but inserting ourselves in their place. Thank you.
And Representative
Thank you very much, Madam Speaker. I'm tired, too.
I like it.
Promotion.
I like the sound of that.
Maybe I'm foreshadowing what's to come. Who knows?
And might I add, you look beautiful today.
That's right. I used to say Madam Speaker many times in my first 2 years in office because we had a lady speaker. I have concerns about the legislation. I'm not going to object to moving the bill to the next committee. So, and the bill will have plenty more opportunities for those that oppose this legislation to note those concerns and hopefully convince, well, not maybe not necessarily hopefully, but they'll have that opportunity to convince members of other committees to prevent the bill from going forth, or perhaps if it got to the floor, it could be voted down there. I don't know what the future holds, but I do want to note concerns similar to Representative Seaton's. I think what I'll do is vote to move the bill, however, note do not pass recommendation on the sheet, but just don't have a real high comfort level at this point. I think there's potential for this legislation. Perhaps it could be modified more than it has been with this amendment, but the concerns that have been noted, I basically share. Thank you.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. I think it seems pretty clear to me that this is a bill that addresses a problem that doesn't exist, and I concur with Representative Seaton.
And I have come to that conclusion also. This is not the normal trend this is not the normal thing we do in Alaska. We try to make sure that what we do doesn't have any ramifications in other areas, and I agree with what Representative Seaton has said. I'm just concerned that this is setting a precedent, and the wishes of the committee is that we move this bill, and so we have an objection, so I will go ahead and call the roll.
Representative Corey?
Yes.
Representative Representative Seaton?
No.
Representative McGuire?
Yes.
Representative Anderson?
Yes.
Representative Sisna?
Yes.
Representative Gardner?
No.
No.
Four yeas, three nays.
Okay.
Madam Chair, do you promise we don't have to talk about eyes ever again?
Thank you. No, because
let's Sharon
make
first.
A big commitment.
Anyway, thank you, everyone, for spending the time. I appreciate everyone that has flown up and done a lot in this on this bill. And
oh, yeah.
We're adjourned.
We're here.